Quick, name a couple who've won the American Birkebeiner. David Norris broke away from the field early last year to win the 2023 American Birkebeiner by minutes. It was an amazing feat that has little precedence in terms of sheer audacity in Berkey wins. His significant other, Jessica Yee, narrowly missed her second win just minutes after David celebrated down much of Main Street, and this has made clear that this is a modern American Birkebeiner couple who are still having an impact at the sharp end of the spear as elite Berkeys go. And they formalized their connection to the race by becoming ambassadors for Team Berkey, the pro team with the Berkey's namesake run out of Hayward and Minneapolis. We welcome the 2020 American Birkebeiner Women's Champion and two-time and defending champion David Norris to the podcast. When the snow falls, rise to the occasion with an Aaron's snow throw. Since 1933, Aaron's has been building durable, reliable machines that have been handed down from generation to generation. From powerful single-stage units to all-steel two-stage beasts loaded with features, Aaron's has the perfect snow thrower to clear your path down to the pavement. Whatever the forecast calls for this winter, it's nothing an Aaron's can't handle. After all, there's a reason they're called the king of snow. Find out why at your local Aaron's dealer. David and Jessica, welcome to Threshold.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, long last. We're gonna start talking about you guys, but I know you guys just arrived at the Berkey coming off of Minneapolis, and let's take 3 minutes to just to talk about arriving at the Berkey after Minneapolis. Like, how was Minneapolis for you guys?
Minneapolis was incredible. The atmosphere was something I've done a lot of World Cups, and that was insane. The coolest World Cup I've ever done by a landslide. And it was so cool. Like, I've been to ones where there's been a lot of people cheering, but to have so many people know your name was really special. So it was really cool.
How about you, David?
Yeah, I totally agree with Jess. It was crazy. I feel super lucky that, yeah, we got to do this World Cup, because, you know, the first Minneapolis would have been just a sprint race. So we, unfortunate for that first round of Minneapolis World Cup, we actually, you know, lucked out by having a distance race this go around. So we got to experience it. And yeah, that was incredible. The fans, all the cheering, and then to double it up with the Berkey and how many people are here. It's kind of crazy. That's just like 2 weeks of ski madness in America.
Cool. So, this is going to be our pre-Berkey episode. We always do a Berkey episode every season on Threshold going in, and you're both winners. So, but you guys have, I think you have a really interesting story. You're a couple, and let's just start with a little background. So I was coaching collegiately when the two of you were skiing in college. So I remember you guys, and I knew just off the scuttlebutt that the two of you were kind of a package deal already back then. How did the two of you meet, and did your ski careers, and how did your ski careers really shape your relationship, and vice versa? How has your relationships kind of shaped your ski careers? Anyone can start.
Well, we met through skiing. We met at junior nationals, actually. And then we skied together in college at Montana State. And then I guess I would say your ski career's probably been more shaped.
I feel like mine was really shaped, because I feel like David was really like, I'm going to APU, I'm going back to Alaska. And I was like, yep, I'm coming, kind of thing. So that was like probably really influential. I don't know if I would have gone back to Anchorage otherwise. But I always knew I was going to try to ski for the Australian team and do World Cup post-college. I just don't know would have looked like me going to APU at the time. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you guys, Jessica, you're Australian. And that's kind of, but you don't have an Aussie accent. So just kind of explain that a little bit, kind of the Australian thing. Like, how big is Australia in your life today? And like, where did you grow up? And I know that you grew up, I believe you grew up in Anchorage area. Is that correct? Like, you spend a lot of time in Alaska too?
Kind of. So I was born in Australia. Yeah. My mom is originally from Australia. My whole family lives there. My dad is from New Jersey, but he moved there in like 1980. That's where they met. And then he worked for ConocoPhillips, and basically the office shut down. And so I grew up, actually lived in Texas for 6 years and then Dubai for 6 years. So I was kind of all over before I went. I say Alaska. I moved there when I was 12. That's mostly where I grew up. And then that's where I started skiing too. So I still go back to visit family. Like, we were there this spring. But we don't, No accent.
So you're culturally, you're actually an Aussie, but you're, yeah. I mean, you're culturally an Aussie just without the accent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And David, what have you enjoyed about that? Have you enjoyed any part of that? I mean, do you like Australia? Is it cool to be Jess's boyfriend and be able to go to Australia?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I love the Aussie vibes and hanging out there. I mean, honestly, it'd be so sweet to get dual citizenship.
I know. If you didn't say, I was going to say he's really trying to get citizenship.
Oh,
cool.
Not trying that hard in the fact that, like, I guess I'm not being willing to move there right at this moment. But yeah, it'd be awesome.
Awesome. Cool. Well, I learned something there because I didn't know how tight you guys were with Australia. That's great. But neither of you grew up, let's kind of dive into the Berkey thing here. Neither of you grew up with the Berkey thing in your local or regional culture. Do either of you remember the first time you heard about the Berkey or thought about doing it?
I definitely, so I had a teammate, Tyson Flaherty, that was skiing he did APU and then moved back to Fairbanks and trained with my kind of high school elite team. And he would do the Berkey year after year. And I remember it was like this huge, you know, big race for him to go down to. And each year, I think he would be in good shape. And then, like, you know, the challenges of like how deep the race really was and how big it was, particularly back then with all the Euros coming over and stuff. Like,
I knew
it was a big deal if like Tyson wasn't getting top 10 because Tyson was like the fastest guy in Alaska. So I was like, this is a huge race.
Yeah.
I feel like I didn't really know much about it. Like, honestly, the hype, like when David went that first year, he was like, you got to go. It's such an awesome race. Like, it never had really been on my radar. And then you went and won and you were just like, that was the most epic thing of my entire ski career. And I was like, I got to go one day, but it always like conflicted with different like international events. So I didn't really get a chance to go until I was in grad school.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. So I'm just going to point out, David, you won it in 2016 were you 25, 26 years old? It's still relatively young for a marathon racer.
Yeah.
And then Jess, you won it in 2020 and David, you won again last year. And Jessica, you almost won again last year. You almost did the double, the home victory for both men's and women's last year. So let's dwell right at the heart of Berkeyland now. How did your first win shape your view and attitude towards the race? I mean, you kind of led to it, but like, you know, did that make the Berkey a big deal to you after you won it the first time?
Yeah, for sure. Not just because I won and I had all those positive experiences from winning, but like, I think just witnessing the race and how like insane Main Street is it was kind of like, you never see that people in the U.S. care about skiing as much as attending the Berkey.
And then at least Midwesterners.
Yeah. And now Minneapolis to me was like 3K. It was a 3K loop of the Berkey finish line. You know, it was like the madness of the Berkey finish line for the entire loop. But it totally shaped, like, having won it. I did also see that like winning helped my skiing a lot. Like, I had to raise money to compete on World Cup, and after winning it gained me some exposure, and people were helping me with all those expenses. So it was kind of like, not like necessarily career defining, but it was really impactful in a positive way.
Yeah. Jessica, did David's win in 2016 kind of make you want to do it more and really make you want to win it more the first time you won?
No, I don't think him winning it made me want to win it. It made me want to do it. But I was really psyched just after that whole thing. I agree with everything he said about being like such a special race, and like, there's nothing like it in terms of just everyone being so psyched for it. And it's like the most, it's always going to be on my radar. I'll come to the Berkey for the rest of my life. Like, so.
That's great.
Yeah.
So David, you and I talked earlier this week about last year's win, and you told me that you and Jessica were talking about how you thought you could win it with kind of a devastating definitive early move, but you just were kind of chickened out in the past and never really wanted to go for it until last year. So your win last year was certainly the most impressive skiway win that I've ever seen at the Berkey, especially considering the strength of the field and who you did that to. So tell me how you got yourself to make that move so early, and then what the race felt like to be out front. I mean, I think you moved it like, was it 11K or was it even that late? Was it before 10K?
Yeah, I moved at the power line. So
yeah, so that's like 5K in 6K.
Yeah, I went at the first sprint preem.
Yeah,
because you know, like everyone else that went for the sprint preem, they immediately sat up, and
yeah.
I think Tyler Cornfield was really the only person that maybe saw it coming. And
okay.
So he came with me and he bridged up to me. He skied really strong. And then he stayed with me for 10K or so. And then basically said, I've got to let you go if I want a chance at the podium myself. So he went back and, I didn't feel like I had to be, like, it wasn't like I was extra brave or something. I think it was just
right.
Like realizing that even if I tried this, I didn't have that much to lose because anybody who bridged up to me, they would be the distance guys. And then those guys likely are the kind of people I'd want to sprint at the finish line.
Sprint against, yeah. Totally.
So it was kind of like, well, if they do catch me at like 20K or 30K or 40K, like we'll all be equally tired, and hopefully they won't be the guys that have the screaming fast last 100 meters. So I was kind of like, I think this is a good plan no matter how it shakes out.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, so what kind of information were you getting when you're out there that long? And did you ever have self-doubt that it was a wrong move? I mean, it's a long way to think about the ski race and what you just bit off at the power line.
You know, I didn't get, so I had really poor information, not like,
okay,
or just lack of information. I asked at Double O, I asked somebody, one of the coaches on the sideline, like, what's my gap? And I think Evan Pengelly said like huge or something. I was like, what does that mean? And then, and then I think towards with like 10K to go, I asked another coach and they said few minutes. So I was like, oh, because I didn't really, you know, once you're in the woods, it could be 45 seconds or 3 minutes and you don't know.
Yeah. So describe this. I mean, you came down Main Street. So first of all, you guys pass each other. Like the women start before the men. And where did you guys, was it on Main Street that you guys passed each other, the two of you?
No, it was 5K to go.
5K to go. Yeah, so it was out in the woods before the lake, right?
Why are you saying no?
Well, it wasn't that.
Maybe it was little further.
It was like 5K before Mosquito Brook.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Mosquito Brook, okay.
Yeah. So at that point, climbing,
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you were climbing. So so Jessica, did it really resonate with you, the fact that David went by and it took so long? And did any other men catch you before the finish?
No, and they did. Like, I thought it was so cool.
I mean, that's amazing that you were 8K out and Dave goes by and nobody comes besides him. So what were you thinking? I mean, you must have known David was going to win as you were sprinting down the line. I actually was the finish line announcer and I miscalled you. I thought you were the French woman, but you were actually racing it out with Elena for your second win, her fourth. Tell me about that race a little bit, like how that unfolded. You and Elena basically got a gap in the last few kilometers on the other chasers, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I was, like, kind of freaking out the whole time because I'm not really a sprinter, and I was, like, we just weren't dropping people, and, like, I kind of knew the last chance to go for it was, I guess, whatever that is, like, 10K to go, and I was kind of planning on it, so it was kind of a coincidence that that's when David passed me, but I 100% had more motivation. Like, you just get, like, fired up. Like, when I saw him coming by himself, I was like, oh my gosh, like, he's doing something cool, I can do something cool. So kind of just went for it there, and I was just so thankful that there weren't more people that held on, because I was concerned about having to outsprint people at the finish. So
cool. So you guys, you go first and second last year. Did that kind of like solidify you? It sounds like it solidified you guys. You Jessica, you said you're coming back to the Berkey forever.
Yeah, I love it.
Dave, what about you, David?
Yeah, I would come back. I'll be back for sure. Like, I'm happy to do it at any point in my life.
Yeah, I want to be one of those people with like 50 on their bib.
That's awesome. Okay, let's. I'm gonna switch gears just a little bit, but you are both also winners of Mount Marathon in Seward, Alaska, a relatively short but brutal, legendary mountain running race that is almost bigger than life in your home state. So these two events seem kind of like country cousins in spirit in competition, sometimes having absolute world-class fields, while other years not so much. But regardless, winning Mount Marathon in Alaska is akin to lore created by winning the Berkey if you're from the Midwest. So what about the two events maybe are similar and what are different? And how does being a winner of each resonate with you in terms of how the public in those regions celebrate you guys? Sorry, many multifaceted question.
I mean, it's really cool to see, I guess, just like the hype around a race like that. Like, I think if you were to ask, like, you know, the two most meaningful, like, wins, it's definitely Mount Marathon and the Berkey for me. And it is because of the community that's involved. Like, you just see how special the event is and the hype around it. And it's just so much more special than other races. So, yeah, I mean, David definitely has more Mount Marathon victories to his name. So it's a really big deal for you.
Yeah. And the similarities is it's pretty remarkable how, like, these two little towns that don't have, you know, small populations and seemingly not a lot going on the weeks before and the weeks after just fill up, and the fan base is massive. People are going nuts for you. And they both, like, in Cable and Hayward, it seems like you'll have snowmobilers that are excited about skiing and they maybe have never really seen skiers otherwise. And the same thing in Mount Marathon, people are down in Seward just enjoying 4th of July weekend. And for this one day a year, they're excited about mountain running. So that is pretty exciting to be cheered for just by, like, people on vacation having fun. And then both races have totally shaped our careers a little bit in sport. Like, Mount Marathon is probably like the most memorable win for me.
The finish lines are really similar. It's crazy because you're like running down Main Street and there's just like all these people. It's creepy. It's the same.
Cool. So talk a little bit about community. I mean, so these are two community events that you both have succeeded at and you're both kind of legendary at. And now you both have moved to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And David, you're coaching the junior team there while you're still continuing to race at a relatively elite level. I know you do a lot of sports. You're sponsored by a mountain bike company and you do a lot of endurance stuff. But how does that community embrace you guys? It seems like you guys really like Steamboat from what I hear. And how do they? What's it like in that community? What's maybe a little bit different from where you come from in Alaska in that community?
When people are super kind to us when we moved there, and like we're embraced really generously and well. And working at the Winter Sports Club, for me, like, it was. They've been flexible and they value like our presence in town. One big difference that I've seen is, like, I've lived in Anchorage and Bozeman and Fairbanks, and all those places have college ski teams and more elite athletes, like past the high school age. And Steamboat, there's not a lot of exposure to older athletes training at a higher level. So it's probably a positive thing for us to be in town and just the high schoolers seeing how, like, more like adult elite level athletes train just day in and day out.
I think just like the small town of it, like, just so I help out with the Winter Sports Club too, coaching like Nordic kids and mountain bike in the summer and then working as a physical therapist. Like, I feel that small town a lot and I feel like my value being there, and it's really cool to be a part of something like that where you really feel like you're making an impact on the kids and their future and just people in general. Like, you can't go like 10 feet without seeing someone, you know. Seriously, it's crazy. Yeah. And I think that's really cool because you do see like the impact that has.
Yeah. And then they do have a really cool like local race circuit with running races and Wednesday night bike races and the Schemo series in the winter. So it's pretty, it's a healthy outdoors endurance junkie community. So like we're fitting in with that.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Seems like a good place for you guys to land.
This episode of Threshold is brought to you by Aaron's Co. As a family-owned manufacturer of outdoor power equipment, Aaron's Co. is celebrating 90 years of shaping landscapes around the world. At Aaron's Co., they love all things snow. With more than 4 million snowblowers produced since 1960, Aaron's is known as the king of snow and is the number one brand of two-stage snowblowers in the world. Their machines are passed down from generation to generation. Visit Aaron's, that's Aarens.com, to find a dealer near you.
So I want to get into the stuff that I think a lot of people who tune into this podcast kind of look for, which would have been a few advice tips on how to ski a successful Berkey on the famed trail from Cable to Hayward, which is, we know is not happening. So since we're going to a 5-lap 50K super elite field at the Berkey Trailhead, and you likely don't know the trail all that well, and everyone else, it looks like, will be doing 3 laps of the Berkey for their Berkey experience, let's maybe pivot on Berkey advice from the ski racing itself to how have you both managed the logistics of housing, meals, tech support, and getting to and from the Berkey start-finish lines in the past, and what are some of the logistical things you feel you've mastered successfully in a Berkey weekend where there's no real central hotel, there's no real central place to eat? What are some advice that you can give to people on preparing for a good Berkey weekend in Hayward and Cable?
Well, we were super fortunate the very first time I did the Berkey. I sent out an email to the local ski club seeing if a family would host us. And so we've had ever since that time, like, creative relationship, and I've just been with the same host family all the years. I know the first year we came, like, we stocked up in Minneapolis and got food there because we didn't know what the grocery stores were like here, but the grocery store in Hayward seems plenty good. And then we actually live past the start line, and so we're coming against traffic. So that's actually maybe, I don't know what the housing situation looks like past the start line, but that seems like a hack that more people could do because, you know, it's so crazy coming from the 00 side heading to Cable. So that seems like a good one. And
dropping a car off the night before is useful at the finish line.
Oh, yeah, at the finish line, get out of there, yeah.
Yeah, like trying
That's a great hack.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I feel like logistically we've been spoiled, so like it's sort of like not the greatest advice necessarily for just like a family that's trying to have to plan it totally from scratch. I'm glad I don't have to like search on Airbnb every year.
Yeah, but there's great aid stations on course, so don't worry about that.
Yeah.
You don't need to, like, you know, bring too much with you. You can always stop for food.
I think some stuff that's actually going to be nice for the fact that it's a 3-lap race. I mean, of course, the real course would be the dream, but because we're on a 3K or 3-lap of 10K, it's, if you have family or friends out there, like, it's going to be so much easier to feed and
For sure.
Get stuff from people. And, you know, like, the spectators that normally can maybe only leapfrog and see somebody at, like, 00 and whatever, some other road crossing. It's kind of nice that, like, families are going to be able to watch their friends or relatives. Like, you're going to see them, like, 20 times in the 30K that they do or 50K, so... I'm thinking
Lopet Cup right now. I'm thinking Lopet Cup right now when I think about it, you know?
Oh, right.
People coming through, yeah. It could be really fun, you know?
Yeah, like, I think in a way, it is a blessing in disguise, sort of, like, especially with Jesse racing and some of the elites. Like, if people want to actually cheer, they will actually get to watch a race where normally it's, you know, you kind of head off into the woods and then you don't see people. So.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll be cool.
And from a racer's perspective, I think it'll be fun to have that crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel a little bit for Jesse that she doesn't get to ski down Main Street
on
this first time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a bummer for her because, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I think she's going to get a lot of love, and I think it's going to be, people are going to be able to see her race the Berkey a lot more and say, hey, I remember when, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. So let's talk about Saturday, the actual, what's going on this Saturday, this 2024 American Berkey Biner. It's not your typical Berkey, like you've been saying. It's still 50K, 5x10 laps, or 5x10K lap. A few World Cup skiers on the start order. I mean, Jesse Diggins is obviously going to be tough to beat. She's the best skier in the world right now for Jessica. But, you know, they're talking about Sophia Lovely maybe starting and maybe Mika Vermeulen. But I've heard that's not going to happen, that they're maybe a little too tired. But still, it's going to be a different elite race. How do all these changes kind of affect your race plans and strategies for Saturday's super elite race?
Well, in a way, I'm kind of psyched because I feel like with Jesse there, it's just like sometimes I'm hoping that, like, I don't want it to be this big bunch group, and I don't always want to be the one that makes the race because you risk, like, getting too tired by trying and failing, but you know right. She's going to make the race, and so I'm kind of psyched right. about that, even though, cool. like, no one's going to beat her. So I think it'll yeah. be cool.
It just takes all the responsibility. Like, yeah, it's like yeah. getting rid of responsibility, right? Like, all yeah. the responsibility's off me now, yeah.
Like, it's great. Not going to be a tea party, so it's going to
yeah,
be
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a great answer. David, what about you on the guy side? I mean, have you heard? I mean, if Vermeulen came, he'd probably be the toughest guy right now, having been on the podium in Canmore. But I heard that he may be rethinking that. Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, I heard he's out, but I don't...
Okay.
I'm not sure. I think there's a German guy, is it Lucas Bogle?
Burgle, yeah. He's yeah. on there.
Patterson skiing really well right now.
For sure.
And yeah. if, you know, and then the other Super Tour guys are, seems like everybody's in good shape. So,
yeah.
It'll be interesting. And the course is fairly flat, rolling.
Yeah.
And then the hills that are there are kind of steeper and punchier. So,
yeah.
I'm kind of curious, like, how it would turn out, but
I'm with Jess. About traffic for that men's race. You have a lot of, like, one thing I've noticed, just looking at it as being a commentator, I'll be at the finish line, but looking at the list of guys, if you take Mika Vermeulen out, there's a lot of parity there if you consider it's a 50K race. Like, there's a lot of people who, you know, I think you're among the favorites there, but there could be the pack could be pretty big. Does that concern you at all with the size of the trail?
No, I kind of am guessing that it will get strung out, like, faster than we think. I think
okay.
with just, like, Scott doesn't want it to be a chill 50K.
For sure.
And
yeah. Good point.
He'll do his part. He'll be probably the guy shaking it up early on.
Right.
So I think it will stretch out. And then maybe what might be a little different is there's so many turns and stuff in this year's course where, like, right. as we start to catch the women's wave, yeah. usually it's like they really do just kind of, like, get to one side and the boys take the other side and we
yeah.
neatly pass each other. But with a ton of turns and people taking best yeah. line, that could be a little bit of a, like, we just need to be cautious and realize that it, like, this 1 second isn't going to be the deal breaker of the race.
Right.
Like,
right.
Cause in those situations, like, I don't want to be the jerk that stomps yeah. on someone's pole and is mean to the girl you're passing. And obviously, like, I don't want the guy behind me to crash into somebody, but, you know, when you're racing and everybody's competitive, it does sometimes get a little silly like that.
Yeah. Any concerns for you, Jessica, about the traffic?
Ooh, that's always a concern for me, but maybe not yeah. more so than normal. Like, I like things to get strung out. I don't like dealing with packs and people. Right. So.
Right. Well, it's going to be interesting no matter what. We've never seen this. I think it's the first time. It's definitely the first time the Berkey's ever been able to pull off a Berkey Biner, an actual Berkey Biner 50K, with the weather they've had because of the snowmaking they put in place there. So kudos to the American Berkey Biner Foundation for that. So I'm going to, final question for you guys about the Berkey. If you could just pick one thing that you use, the one thing, I realize there's a lot of things that you love about the Berkey, but what's the one best thing about the Berkey in your mind? Like, when you think of Berkey, what's the best thing about it?
I think community, like, coming here and seeing friends and reconnecting with people and just seeing how many people are psyched about cross-country skiing and psyched about this race.
Yeah, I was going to say friends. Like, yeah. I mean, like, I love racing, and I can jam hard on, like, a 1K loop that is total trash. But this is, like, actually going back to the fact mm-hmm. that they got the 10K loop. When we got out there right. yesterday, I was skiing with Scott, Jess, and Hunter Wunders, and we all agreed that this was probably the best man-made loop we've ever seen.
I mean, it's incredible.
Really? Like,
what they've put together is incredible. Yeah.
It's that's so great.
And maybe that's part of the community thing. It's like what they have done to rally for this race is right. amazing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's great and to then, hear. That's great to hear. I've seen some video and it looks great.
It's awesome. And then Berkey Week's just, the reason it's special to me is like, it's just one week where you do see all these friends that it's tough to reconnect with otherwise.
For sure.
It's like a reunion of skiers.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing you guys there. I've got a cold right now, if you can't tell, so stay away, or I'll have a mask on to make sure that you know that. I mean, hopefully by then it's gone. It's not a real bad one, but I think it's just the stress of the weekend in Minneapolis just got me. But I'm excited to see you guys there, excited to see how you do, and really want to thank you guys for joining me on Threshold for this Berkey episode, and good luck.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a bunch.
Winning the Berkey has always been a big deal around here, and by around here, I mean in the Midwest. Every year we spend a little time throwing light on it as we approach the big race. Heck, the marquee event in many people's calendar every year. This year's American Birkebeiner feels very important for several reasons, though. First, Mother Nature is cited in the record books as quote-unquote the winner in both 2000 and 2017. Mother Nature simply didn't oblige and killed the event, with no snow. This year would have fallen to the same fate were it not for the infrastructure put in place to create the loop the Berkey skiers will actually ski this week. This was all due to the infrastructure created by the American Birkebeiner Foundation. A link in our description will help you find your way to donate. I don't need to highlight this year's Berkey will not be possible on the beloved Berkey Trail from Cable to Hayward. It's not going to be a traditional Berkey. We know that. So we need to celebrate the Berkey. It will be possible due to the hard work and generosity of so many who love the Berkey. We will have an event, a fairly robust one if you consider the actual winter Berkeyland has experienced this year. Aside from the topic on our minds, that of losing winter altogether, and Threshold plans to address this in upcoming episodes with people qualified to speak intelligently on the topic. Watch for that soon. But in the meantime, let's celebrate what we have. We can't always beat Mother Nature, and in fact, we shouldn't want to. But this year, there will be races, results, times, and names of race winners. For the record, I'll take that under the circumstances, because the Berkey spirit lives inside of us, and we can make the Berkey what we need it to be for us all. That's our show for this episode. Happy Berkey Week. I'm Chad Sumla. Thanks for listening.